Henry Ford was a man of many contradictions. As an American Experience documentary about him that airs tonight on PBS stations reveals, Ford despised rich people and continued to see himself as an everyman and a champion of the middle class, even as his Model T made him one of the wealthiest men in the world. Ford's innovative use of the assembly line in his factories sped up and routinized his employees' jobs from that day forward, and yet Ford continued to long for the quieter and more congenial rural way of life his factories had helped eliminate. Here now to discuss the documentary simply called Henry Ford are Sarah Colt, its writer, producer, and director, and Greg Grandin, a professor of history at NYU, who's written a book about Henry Ford in Brazil, and he's also featured in the film. Welcome to our show.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much. Yeah, thanks for having us.
Sarah, after Henry Ford became successful, he liked to tell people that he was a rags-to-riches story and that he'd left home because his domineering father hadn't approved of his ambitions. How much truth was there to that story?
You know, it's such an interesting aspect of Ford that he kind of creates this mythology of his childhood and his past because he grew up in a fairly successful farm family. His father was a successful farmer who had immigrated from Ireland, and his father was relatively supportive of him. Now, I think he probably did want his son to be a farmer, but his son was not going to be a farmer, and when that was clear, he helped him find his first job in Detroit. So it was really fascinating to me when I was working on the film, trying to understand why did Henry Ford care to present this slightly inaccurate, not a complete lie, but sort of an inaccurate telling of his background and his past.
Perhaps it was because he didn't go to college and he was kind of defensive about the fact that he went to Detroit when he was 16 years old.
I mean, I think it's about sort of being a self-made man and living up to this myth, this American myth that you can, you know, he pulled himself out of nothing, and it's a real, you know, I think he wanted to be an American hero in the vein of sort of the Horatio Alger hero, and I think that appealed to Henry Ford. And you're right, he probably had insecurities because he didn't have an education beyond the eighth grade.
As was revealed in this, a trial when he sued a newspaper for slander when they, what did they call him?
An anarchist.
An anarchist, but also a...
ignorant anarchist.
An ignorant anarchist.
And he turned out, he obviously wasn't an anarchist, but he turned out to be totally ignorant of American history. You would have thought Henry Ford, who was so in love with the whole concept of America, would have known the years the revolution occurred in. He thought it was 1812.
I mean, he really is revealed as being very uneducated in that libel trial, and I think it's a very uncomfortable moment for him. At that point, he's a hugely successful industrialist, and he gets his way most of the time, but when he's put on the stand, he has to answer their questions, and he brought the suit. I mean, he brought it on himself, but I don't think he expected to be kind of humiliated in the way that he was during this trial.
Now, the first automobile company Ford launched wasn't called the Ford Motor Company, Greg. Do you know the story of that?
Well, it was the Detroit Motor Company. I mean, it was founded in the late 19th century, and it was one of 50-something motor companies. Detroit was booming. It was diverse. It was a free-for-all, and Ford was one of many.
But he wanted to do something different from all the others, and his investors pulled out because he refused to design the luxury automobile that they believed the market called for. Instead, he was determined to create a car that an ordinary person could afford to
buy. That's what he did in 1908 with the Model T, and that revolutionized the car industry. His innovations was to focus on a car that people could afford, that farmers could afford, that the common person could afford, and that in turn revolutionized in many ways the political economy of the U.S.
And Sarah, you point out in the film that was a factor in. And his dislike for the wealthy, that disagreement with those early investors.
Yeah, I think he always had this very large ego and a belief in himself. I think a lot of entrepreneurs who have the kind of success Henry Ford had have that. It's sort of a special quality where people can tell you you're wrong and you know that you're right. and failure doesn't seem to stop you. And so he had these early failures, and I think he blames the sort of wealthy investors, that he doesn't like them, he doesn't identify with them. He identifies with farmers and with working men and working people. And so it becomes a sort of a real point of anger for Henry Ford.
Not that he always had good relations with working people, but he did have to rely on investors to start the Ford Motor Company as well. He didn't have any money.
Exactly. Yeah, no, he had to rely on investors, and he was reliant on them for a long time. And
well, did he have a better relation? Did he have better relations with the second group of investors?
I think he did. I mean, he was friendly with his investors, and in fact, the Dodge brothers, who in the film we tell a story, the story of how Henry Ford ends up sort of tricking his investors out into selling their shares of Ford Motor Company. Now, this is a later story in the film. But he was friendly with the Dodge brothers, and the Dodge brothers came to his son's wedding. So they were, you know, it wasn't that he wasn't friendly with these people, but when it sort of came down to it, ideologically, he didn't like investors. He saw them as parasites who just, you know, ate off his hard work and his innovations. And didn't really do anything for the company.
What he did is he resigned and made his 25-year-old son, Edsel, president of the company. And, Greg, as I understand it, some of the things that he did would violate a lot of the laws today.
Well, he did rule over his company with an iron will. He did have a certain self-determination.
He could be called a control freak, don't you think?
To put it mildly, when it came to labor relations, when it came to his own family. In some ways, he created the prototype of the modern, what we call the modern corporation. Power was diffused. People didn't have formal titles. He encouraged initiative, but then oftentimes he squashed that initiative with an iron will.
Now, we think of him as the creator of the Model T, just kind of springing out of his imagination. But I don't know how far down the alphabet T is. He did start creating models beginning with A, didn't he?
He did, and he went pretty much down the alphabet until he was satisfied with the Model T, which was 1908. He built the Model T from 1908 up until 1927, pretty much unaltered, with only minor changes over the course of that nearly two decades.
Inspiring Volkswagen, I suspect, somewhere
right
down the line.
Exactly.
But that's because he felt that the Model T was a perfect car. It didn't need to be improved, despite pressures from other people in his company and his own son to come up with new models, because the competition, General Motors, Chrysler, were doing very well with newer cars.
Yeah, and he was also opposed to the notion of the car industry with a kind of fashion industry model with new styles and new adornments every year. Ford was a walking contradiction. He pioneered modern consumerism, but he was against what he called the frippery of modern life. He didn't think people should buy things just for the sake of buying things.
And his desire to make a car that farmers and factory workers could afford, supposedly Paul Krugman says he doesn't believe that story, that by paying his workers $5 a day, he created a whole new market for his own cars. But still, he sounds kind of noble at times, and then there was this significant dark side to him. For example, his anti-Semitism, Sarah, to the point where bought a Michigan newspaper to distribute through his car dealerships around the country to talk about his negative feelings about the Jews.
Well, I feel like this is the key to trying to understand Henry Ford, is to see this this. You know, is it transformation, or is it just the power allows his inner self to be, you know, he can share it with the world? And I spent a lot of time trying to figure out, you know, where does this anger and this, I mean, the virulent anti-Semitic ideas that he has, why does he feel compelled to share it with everyone? Why does he need to buy a newspaper that he then distributes and requires his dealerships around the country to give out to people who come into the showroom and buy Model Ts? You know, why does he do this? And in trying to get at that, I think you start to understand and get a better picture of this man who has this incredibly productive. He's very productive, and he has, you know, the build up to the Model T is this incredibly creative moment for him. He gathers this team of men who are all incredibly talented and come together with all these amazing ideas, and he's this team leader. He comes out with the Model T, and then he sort of it sort of devolves in some ways. That's sort of the pinnacle, I think, in the early, 1912, when the $5 day. And then he buys the Dearborn Independent in 1918, and that's when sort of all this anger comes out. And it's very complicated.
Well, I wish Orson Welles had looked at Ford as a subject after he did Citizen Kane, because They're kind of similar, often hateful, sometimes idealistic, slightly pitiable.
I mean, if you look at the trajectory of his life, the chronology, right? So the Model T is 1908. In the 1910s, he pioneers the assembly line, right? Not just the assembly line, but the idea of a factory as an integrated set of assembly lines all moving towards the finished product. He really did focus on that with a kind of mania. Then the $5 day in 1914, and it's enormous economic success. And then you start to see a series of political failures, and the most notable one being his failure to keep the U.S. out of World War I. He was a militant pacifist that spent millions of dollars trying to keep the U.S. He thought industrialization should be used for production, not destruction. And the anti-Semitism comes fairly fast on the heels of that. It's the 1920s, and so you see this kind of intersection of enormous economic power, almost unaccountable, where he's at the pinnacle of the industry, of the economy, really answerable to nobody, and that he has a series of political setbacks, including a failed senatorial bid. And I think that's the anti-Semitism sprouts out of that.
Another contradiction is he's an admirer of Hitler. Later, the Ford Company makes a lot of money working for the war effort during World War II. But he really does come across as a control freak at times. In the early days, didn't he send inspectors to his employees' homes and then withhold their pay or fire them if they didn't live up to the moral standards that he had set down? Sarah?
Well, I think Henry Ford had very distinct ideas about how people should live. And he, I think, believed he lived that way and that other people should live as he lived. So, he hated alcohol. He refused to have alcohol in his house. And he thought that alcohol, was really bad for people. And so he thought his workers shouldn't drink alcohol. He didn't drink alcohol. And and in some ways, obviously alcoholism is not great. But he had this notion that if he did it and it worked, other people should live the way he lived. And I think that's certainly where the sociological department comes from, so that he ties his $5 day to this, these requirements that you had to pass inspections in order to receive the raise and actually in order to work for the Ford Motor Company.
And then he hires thugs to make sure his employees don't waste a minute during the workday. Later, he uses the thugs to fight unionization, despite the fact that he said he was a friend of the worker.
Yeah, well, that image of him as a paternalistic, well-paying, he remained a well-paying employer, but that image of the sociological department, that was the name of the department, what we would call human resources today, that sent out the agents to see if boarders were living, if people were drinking, if, what the standard of hygiene was in the houses of mostly immigrants and migrant workers. That was a very relatively short period of time. Fairly soon, the Ford Motor Company grew and became sprawling, and that model of paternalism couldn't hold, and he increasingly came to rely on what was the largest paramilitary force in the world, headed by a former Navy boxer named Harry Bennett, that Ford came to rely on.
He also exercised a lot of control over his son Edsel, didn't he, Sarah, to the point where some people kind of blame Edsel's death at a young age on his father. Edsel, by the way, did drink wine with meals.
I mean, Edsel was a modern, 20th century educated man, and Henry Ford couldn't accept who his son was. And so, I mean, in some ways, it's very much a class issue. His father was a working class man, You know, he happened to be one of the richest men in the world, but his roots were on the farm, and his roots, you know, he was born during the Civil War, and his son Edsel, who, you know, was educated at the best schools in Detroit. Edsel did not go to college, but he was, you know, a well-educated and sophisticated man with taste, you know, in sophisticated taste in art and music. And his father wanted him to be, I think, just like himself, and couldn't accept that Edsel was a very different person, and was, of course, going to be a different person given the success of Henry Ford, his father. So it's I was fascinated from the beginning with this relationship, the father-son relationship. And, you know, Edsel is you know, Henry's only child, his only son, and so there's just a lot put on Edsel, and it's a very tragic father-son relationship.
Well, he actually seemed quite competent, unfortunately not always listened to by his father. We have very little time, but Greg, another fascinating part of the story, the documentary opens and closes with black and white footage of a section of the Brazilian jungle owned at one time by Henry Ford. And you wrote a book about it called Fordlandia, The Rise and Fall of Henry Ford's Forgotten Jungle City, which was published, 2009? Why did he buy 2,500 acres of jungle property? What do you hope to do there, and what's happened to it?
Well, I think
and you have 1 minute.
Yeah, 1 minute. Well, there are two reasons. He wanted to get control of rubber. He controlled every other natural resource that went into the making of the car except rubber. That's the economic reason.
So he wanted to make his own tires?
He wanted to make his own tires. That was nominally the reason. The real reason was that he had become quite restless and dissatisfied with the world that he created. And his attempts to reform capitalism at home, he started setting up these small little model villages in Michigan and elsewhere in the United States, and they all failed. And so it's a classic attempt of going abroad and trying to reform another society after reform at home failed.
And Sarah, that footage is fascinating. A lot of the footage is fascinating, partly because Ford had much of his life filmed.
He did, and he was interested in technology, and motion picture was a new technology, and Ford started his own motion picture company and filmed absolutely everything. And so it's a filmmaker's dream to have, there's 1.5 million feet of film at the National Archives that was all shot by the Ford Motor Company that was at our disposal to make this film.
Well, the film is being broadcast tonight as part of the American Experience series. It's at what time, 8 or 9?
It's most, I think, 9 o'clock in most markets, but check your local listings.
And Sarah Colt wrote, produced, and directed it. She's been joined by Greg Grandin, a professor of history at NYU and author of Fordlandia. Thank you both so much for being on our show today.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us. Great.